This week, Grizzle had the pleasure of speaking with Nancy Davis, founder of Quadrant Capital, to discuss her outlook on the disconnection between the Federal Reserve versus the bond market, her outlook on rates, and how she's navigating market volatility from banking woes as a rate investor.
We have Nancy Davis, who I know everyone knows. She's a regular in Spaces, and she's also on CNBC regularly. We're really excited to have you here. And for those that don't know, she's the founder of Quadrant Capital, which she founded in 2013. Prior to this, she was at Goldman Sachs for nearly 10 years, where she became the head of credit derivatives and over-the-counter trading. So lots of experience. Thank you, Nancy, so much for taking the time to come on here and join us today and share your insights.
It's my pleasure. I look forward to the discussion.
And so I just wanted to kind of start off with maybe going over like what happened this week. You know, we had Jerome Powell raising rates by 25 basis points, but that wasn't really the narrative. It was, although there were hints that this rate hiking campaign may be ending soon, it's clear that he does not intend to cut rates at any point this year. But as we know, the bond market is pricing in rate cuts at every meeting post May. So there seems to be this disconnect between the Fed and the market right now. We also have concerns of banking contagion continuing across the US and Europe, with Deutsche Bank being the latest focus of the turmoil today. Shares, I believe, are down more than 11% following a spike in their credit default swaps. And most of the banks are under pressure again today. So a lot to discuss. But Nancy, before we get into everything, do you want to maybe just tell our audience a bit about yourself and what you do for those that don't know?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. So I'm the founder of Quadratic Capital. Quadratic's been around about a decade. The firm started in 2013. And I'm the portfolio manager. We have two actively managed bond ETFs. The larger and older one is called IVOL. IVOL is the ticker. And then we also have a deflation fund, which is called BNDD. So I'm the PM for both of those actively managed ETFs. And happy to have any questions. Both funds are long fixed income volatility, specifically U.S. interest rate vol, which has definitely been moving quite a bit, especially with the Silicon Valley blow up. It's always short vol that causes all these pains. So I'm happy to take any questions and have a lively discussion with everyone in the spaces. And we appreciate everyone joining.
Maybe let's just start off talking about what were your takeaways from Powell's Wednesday's comments on interest rates and how the market was reacting to that.
Yeah, so I definitely think the Fed is in a very tight problem with the balance sheet expanding so much, especially with the new banking facilities. So that sort of backdoor quantitative easing, they're not calling it that, but it is expanding the Fed's balance sheet, which could potentially be more inflationary. And also with the market pricing in so many, cuts now, the Fed is really in a tight situation between balancing, managing inflation versus all the financial stability. And I don't think, things like Deutsche Bank today are helping the situation.
And I know the Fed's balance sheet is arguably just as important as what they do with interest rates. Could you maybe help people listening understand, why the balance sheet matters and maybe your expectations for their balance sheet over the next 12 months?
Yeah, so the balance sheet is, there are a couple pieces of the balance sheet. There's what's called the SOMA holdings, which is the System Open Market Operations. This is a part of the bond buying that actually takes place where the New York Fed actually goes out and buys bonds in the open market. In my, Twitter feed, I put some links. I can dig those up and resend them. But it's all public information, and you can see how big the balance sheet is. And I think one thing that surprises a lot of people is, everyone has been very focused on rate hikes, rate cuts, like what's being priced in on the Fed's policy rates. But I think a lot of people don't realize how much the Fed expanded their balance sheet during the COVID, the start of the COVID pandemic. There was more QE done in a 8-week period in March 2020 than there was in the prior 9 years of QE. So the Fed's balance sheet has really blown up. And then with all the additional sort of swap lines that are going out, it's not active bond buying, but it is expanding the balance sheet even more. And so that's, I think, the question is, you know, right now, you know, it's a definitely a tough situation. And I think the Fed has to face the fact that its rate hikes have not only failed to control inflation, but they've started to cause instability in the banking system. And it's sort of a catch-22 right now, because now they're expanding the balance sheet even more, which could be even more inflationary.
Oh, please, please chime in. Anyone that has any questions, please go ahead.
Hey, Nancy. Thanks for taking some time for us today. I just had a question on after Jerome Powell's comments on Wednesday, as you saw what the bond market did and what the stock market has done, do you think bond investors are anticipating what the Fed may actually do? Are stock investors, is there a disconnect between bond investors and how stock investors are viewing what could happen in the future? For example, I'm thinking if the Fed is cutting rates like people expect, is that ultimately going to be good or bad for stocks?
I mean, it's tough to say why they're cutting rates, you know, if they're cutting rates because we have bank runs happening around the world, that is probably pretty bad for risk assets generally. If they're cutting rates because inflation is cooling and it's not a problem anymore and they can loosen policies, that could be potentially good. And so I think the problem is kind of like why they're doing it. Right now, I'd say the rate cuts are more in response to kind of the banking crisis and the lack of confidence, which is probably pretty negative to stocks. But I'm not, you know, I'm not a single stock expert. I'm more of a fixed income person. But I do think I can talk about credit. I do think credit spreads are pretty tight still. Credit, you know, most of the sell-off in bonds last year was really from it was from their interest rate sensitivity, whereas credit spreads really haven't widened very much. So I know I kind of got into a little bit of a, you know, debate on the CNBC on Wednesday afternoon about whether equities or credit are better. But in my book, I mean, if you're going to take corporate beta risk, I would say it's probably better to do it in the stock market than the credit markets, because it's a similar, you know, it's just different parts of the capital structure, but credit spreads do look pretty tight to me.
And how do you think the yield inversion is going to play out if we do have, let's say, a cut within our Fed funds rate in that sense? And specifically, do we see a situation where they'll be continuously cutting and or potentially having a pause in the sense of hikes and leaving the levels at that level? And we see an increase in integrations between, let's say, the SOMA balance sheet and other forms of QT and or QE. If we're looking at, let's say, the balance sheet, specifically the SOMA, and I'll post up something in the nest really quickly. On January 1st, we saw the actual, like, let's say, the down peaks of the QT phases that we saw. And ever since then, we've been only seeing incremental buybacks within the actual balance sheet.
Yeah, no, exactly to your point. The balance sheet is expanding and they're not calling it, they're still saying they're doing quantitative tightening, which they are with these very tiny caps, but the caps are, last week we had $300 billion of backdoor, you know, swap lines go out and another 100 million and the caps are 90 a month. So they're tiny and compared to the kind of backdoor QE that's happening. And to your point, you know, let me just read some stats off of Bloomberg. Like I see the a 3-month T-bill is currently yielding 4.73 is what I see today. Whereas the 10-year is 3.36. So you have this very massively inverted yield curve, and the yield curve has been moving less inverted, so it's been steepening, but it's still massively inverted, and that's really not a healthy sign historically when you've had the yield curve steepen out of inverted levels. That's typically an indicator that we're, you know, near or going to be having a recession soon.
Nancy, I had a really interesting question I wanted to ask you because your expertise. As you look at corporate credit spreads, you said they're relatively tight still. Do you think are spreads still a reliable indicator of credit risk, or is there so much moral hazard in the market because, you know, bond investors just think, oh, if we run into trouble, no one's going to take any losses. The Fed is going to bail us out. So spreads don't accurately reflect the real risk out there.
Well, I think, you know, there's only two, you know, if I kind of simplify the bond markets, I'd say there are two types of bond risks. There's rate risk, which is, you know, everybody's very focused on duration right now. And then there's spread risk. And there are a couple different types of spread risk, but one of them is corporate spread risk, which is the, you know, amount that you get paid to take, you know, credit risk above government bonds in any market. And there are a lot of different types of spread risk, but there are things like, you know, the CMBS market, which is a commercial mortgage market. And that's probably, you know, something that people should really be keeping an eye on, especially because a lot of the smaller and regional banks, they have a lot of commercial mortgages on their balance sheet, which, you know, what blew up Silicon Valley Bank was just mortgages, U.S. residential mortgages, which are, you know, easy to mark to market and have listed CUSIPs, whereas the CMBS and commercial mortgage market is less, I'd say, transparent. And so there are all these different types of spread risks, but whether it's a commercial mortgage, a agency mortgage, whether it's a high-yield bond, an investment-grade bond, all of those risks have spread risk to corporates for the most part.
And how does that affect these balance sheets, specifically on the books of the individuals that are holding these assets and when we're seeing massive compressions?
Yeah, so if you own a bond, like let's just take an investment grade corporate bond, you have kind of two ways that you could make money or two ways you could lose money. One is, you know, all bonds have duration, so you want yields lower, and then you want credit spreads tighter to make money off of that spread. And when credit spreads widen, that is typically when equities sell off. So it's a very, I would say, similar beta to the equity market because it still is that embedded corporate risk. And then you can add other types of spread risk, like mortgage market, whether it's residential or commercial mortgages on top of that. So I think that's kind of generally the way to think about, you know, only two types of risk. It's just a question of what type of spread risk it is.
So Nancy, as you look across credit markets, whether it's MBS or just like typical corporate bonds, do you think spreads are pricing in a situation where the Fed is cutting because something broke? Is that being priced in right now or not really?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more, you know, the Powell probably shouldn't have hiked this week, and he did. And that's just causing kind of more of, you know, like think about if you were a regional bank and the Fed just hiked rates more, that's more of a pull out of bank deposits into money market funds. So it just kind of exasperates the problem for, you know, the kind of the flow of funds because people, you know, people have access electronically and there's so much information, especially with all the technology innovations, that capital can move pretty quickly. And so I do think, you know, it's not being priced right now for kind of financial instability. The Fed is kind of, I would say, being a little opaque about, you know, the pain that they're causing by hiking rates so quickly, which they probably just should have been reducing their balance sheet the whole time. That would probably be a better way to, you know, keep financial stability because the whole, you know, if you just take a thousand step, you know, view from the world, like the whole premise of the banking system is predicated on, you know, borrowing short term and lending long term. And when you have a massively inverted yield curve, which you do, you know, right now, it's less inverted than it was before Silicon Valley blew up. March 8th was the low of the invertedness. It's still inverted, but that's not good for the banking system. So I feel like the Fed, you know, this is my opinion, not my firm's opinion, but in my opinion, I think the Fed was a little bit tricked by, you know, if you think about, you know, NIMs, net interest margins, you know, it's kind of like they were sort of pushed towards don't really touch the balance sheet, just hike rates. And I think they probably should have been, especially given the caps are so tiny, even with the doubling of the caps in September, it's nothing and not material. So I don't think the rate hikes have been as potent because there's so much balance sheet expansion.
Dear Point, please go ahead. I see you have your hand up, and thanks so much for joining us.
Not a problem. I mean, I saw Nancy and I've missed her so much on Spaces. I just had to, you know, come and visit her. So I hope everything's going well. First I'll talk about the banks, and then after that, maybe I have a question for Nancy. I think, you know, like 6 months ago, we were kind of talking about the cocoa bonds, Nancy, and obviously that's now front headline news for the Europeans. But on the domestic situation, what's very interesting was I pulled some stuff off Refinitiv last night. For one of those charts, you can actually get it off FRED. But if you look at deposits, the change in billions on a year-over-year basis between large and small chartered commercial banks, large commercial banks have actually seen larger outflows than the regionals, which I was actually very surprised about. But, you know, this is, I guess, to your comments, Nancy, where I'm wondering what happens here is, you know, if you look at the spread between a 3 month money market fund and a 3 month CD, it's like 425 basis points. In 2007, CD rates moved with a lag, but not like the lag that we were seeing. I think the spread in 2007, I think money market funds were at like maybe, I don't know, 400 or 500 basis points. And CD, 3 month CD rates were at like, you know, 300. So like a spread of 200 basis points. So as far back as I could go, I had never seen the spread this like wide. And so I think that that's very interesting because unless, you know, you raise CD rates or you raise savings rates and rates just kind of across the board, you know, you're going to continue to see those outflows, not just from large commercial banks like we've seen on the week over week basis, because the Fed posts those on a weekly basis. But I think that it's going to continuously get worse. And that's kind of like to your point where I'm like, why did Powell raise? Because now you're just going to see even more inflows into money market funds. So if you look at the AUM, again, that's the change in billions on a year-over-year basis. It's up like $200 billion, which almost coincides with the outflows from the large commercial banks. And so, you know, I this obviously comes on the back of rising money market funds. Like I was saying, the massive spread that you see between money market funds, savings rates, CD rates. And so I'm just like, what do we do? Because if these banks raise their rates, right, then obviously, you know, you're going to have margin compression and earnings are going to get hit. And, you know, that's not good for anybody as well. So first of all, I've been so reluctant to do that. And two, if they don't do it at like if they don't take, you know, savings rates up to like 4.5%. I mean, I have a hard time seeing this money market inflow stopping. And I mean, I feel that that's going to continue to coincide with even more drastic outflows from, you know, not just small banks, but large banks as well. And, you know, I mean, I would assume that the Fed would have to cut because, you know, if you're Jamie Dimon or you're Goldman Sachs, like, I feel like you're picking up the phone right now and saying like, hey, like you guys are screwing us, right? Like, it's not even regional banks at this time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There, I mean, I'm just, the Fed continues to get, you know, it wrong, right? Wrong about transitory, stubborn about that, wrong about hiking rates, continue to do it. And they're just causing, you know, it's more gasoline on the fire. And then they're expanding the balance sheet even more. So it's just, you know, I just feel, I know it's just kind of mind blowing, but yeah, it's just, it's creating more of a problem. And I think the thing that's so frustrating too is we had so much banking reform, you know, after the financial crisis, and so much like political effort and waste of money and all this banking reform. And why is the savings account yielding nothing? You know, it's like, I'm almost like, you know, bring it on, because the banks are going to have to compete for deposits right now. That's going to be what happened. Like, how can you lend money overnight to the Fed and get 4.75 and pay a, you know, savings account nothing? It's really not fair. So I'm not, you know, I definitely think the Fed is adding fuel to the fire with Wednesday's decision. I think it was completely foolish. And it was also weird to see Powell talking about your deposits are safe, and then Yellen coming out and contradicting him, and then the next day backing off those comments. Like, you just want to be like, who is steering the boat? You know, do they know what they're doing? Like, that was so strange, right?
It's a comedy. Like you, this can't be the biggest and the best central bank in the world.
It almost seemed accidental, the timing, right? It's like, you know that they have to have spoken that day, right? So, like, it almost seems like one of their comments were not supposed to be released publicly while the other one was speaking, because they were very much so contradictory.
But one thing that's not surprising is Powell's, let's say, increase in hikes. Like, on the pre-FOMC, it was pretty clear, like, he's a lawyer and he's going to say, we don't foresee a systemic risk within our institutions. And that's where it's becoming, like, fairly curious, because in theory, we could have allowed the actual banking fund term program to be implemented before SVB's actual exposure and the actual ideas of a banking crisis entering the psychology of your users and your depositors. And essentially, now I have a question, is if we see a fleet towards, let's say, treasuries, is there a potentiality where, like in World War situations, we saw a payment a redaction in the sense by the government issued longer term loans when those, or I should say, issued longer term treasuries when they came to maturity in order to remain solvent?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of irony. I think that's a really astute question. And that's kind of the irony of the whole thing, is everybody's been very focused on the not mark to market within, you know, whether it is Silicon Valley or, you know, all the other banks that have been under the lens. But like, what about the Fed itself? You know, there's a whole bunch of losses sitting there. And the more they hike rates, the more losses they're causing for us as the taxpayers. And I don't know. I don't know about you guys, but I just felt like Powell was asked a question about banking regulation. And in the Q&A, someone said something about, like, do you what if you're under investigation or something? And he was like, 100%. I felt like it was like talking to my teenage kids at the time, because they always say 100%, you know. but he said something also. I'm paraphrasing. This is off memory, but he said, like, if I did know, I wouldn't share them. And I know that just struck me as like, oh my gosh, like, that's so insincere. Like, who would say something like that? But yeah, it's definitely, I didn't have a lot of confidence coming out of that Q&A. I think it was one of his worst presentations or Q&A sessions ever.
And Nancy, what are you seeing? Oh, sorry, Brendan, go ahead.
She just said that. I was just agreeing. Like, she said, you know, he didn't feel confident coming out of that. It felt like he didn't feel confident.
Yeah. And Nancy, what are you seeing these days in swaption vol?
It's skyrocketing up. I mean, Powell said he didn't know how the failure of SVB happened. And I was just like, what? You know, what the hell are you talking about? Like, what do you mean you don't know how it happened? And then he said that, you know, some comment about, like, he hopes, you know, they were not hedging correctly. They were not handling it correctly. And so I think every single CFO and treasurer out there has to be looking at their mortgage exposure and have to be thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, we don't want to be the next Silicon Valley Bank. And a lot of people, you know, before the Fed did all this QE and all this kind of manipulation with buying bonds, which a third of their SOMA holdings are mortgages, most mortgage investors would hedge that negative convexity, that prepayment risk that exists in the mortgage market. It was just normal. It was like normal course of business that people would buy U.S. rate volatility to hedge the embedded short vol inside mortgages. And so I think what's going on right now is every vol is super bid because everybody's like, oh my gosh, we don't want to be the next poster child for, mismanaging our securities.
And now I have to ask this question because I'm sorry, I always have so many questions for Nancy, but so for me, we had CS, right? Obviously, no surprise there. They sold off securitization, 6 months ago to PIMCO and Apollo, most profitable part of the business. I mean, they were essentially a global asset management firm and retail banking at that point. I mean, it wasn't any longer kind of the gargantuan it once was, but now, so we have, everything going on with UBS. Now we have this spilling over into Deutsche. And kind of my question is, you had the 17 billion of CoCos disappear. And that market's what, 265 billion. Now what we're seeing is obviously, you're seeing perpetual CoCos rise, on the change of, Deutsche Bank's credit profile. CDSs are rising. I know a lot of people are talking about this. With default risk rising, obviously the perpetual CoCos underperforming. Fixed tenor CoCos are doing fine, but that makes up maybe like 15 or 20% of overall CoCo issuance. And then, kind of my question as well is, perpetual CoCos have always been called on their first call date. And so, banks don't necessarily have to exercise the call. If the issuer chooses not to redeem its bonds, it does, to some extent, force investors to reinvest based on the prevailing rate environment of risk-free yield. And we saw this happen with Credit Suisse, their July 2021 compared to the July 22. The market was expecting a redemption of, like, I think it was like 750 basis point coupon bond in the 22nd of June of last year. So its price was moving pretty steadily over this period. But the Credit Suisse's CDS rose rapidly back then. That was kind of when the first news came out about worries of Credit Suisse, and its refinancing cost was 975 basis points, had already exceeded the coupon rate reset of 860 basis points. So kind of with all of that being said, do you see kind of a possibility of CoCo contagion? Because I mean, pension funds are holding these, banks are holding these, because we haven't had any sort of bad economic data since the sub-sovereign debt crisis or any kind of worry of banking risk. And now that that's happening, holding these perpetuals is becoming extremely expensive relative to holding or rolling into fixed tenor. And so I feel like this could kind of be the next contagion, problem, but I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that. I know that was like a lot of information, that's just kind of, I wanted to see your thoughts there because the CoCo market's kind of starting to worry me a bit.
Yeah, and I remember, talking with you on one of the spaces like probably 6 months ago about these AT1, they're not really bonds, they reverse convert into either equity when you don't want it or nothing. They're just IOUs. And this was the Basel III kind of solution to not have taxpayers bail out the banks. Now it's basically just bondholders bail out the banks. And so the issue is that these instruments are in a lot of bond portfolios, whether it's a pension fund or insurance company or mutual funds. They're all over the place in the financials buckets, and they're basically yield enhancement securities to kind of get that spread above, a more senior piece of paper. I definitely think, the 17 billion of losses from Credit Suisse are nothing compared to the size of the overall market. But that goes back to, I think, exactly your point, that I think credit spreads really probably should be widening out because, you know, although we've had a big sell-off in bonds, it's been mostly from interest rates, not from credit spreads widening. And I think now you're seeing, you know, that kind of premium. And I think it's also, you know, investors, now that you have, you know, overnight lending to the Fed is 4.75, it just raises the bar for every single investment out there, right? You need to have a return that's more than, you know, the overnight rate to make it worth your while. And so it is definitely going to cause a problem, and I think across multiple asset classes.
And I think what's interesting is when you mentioned the pension structures, these top 21 nations and all of their pension structures had exposures within their bond constructions, especially when we're looking at Santander and how they're necessarily allowing the liquidity runs for these AT1 convertible equity COCOs in that sense. And if we're looking at it, it's directly for that, an access to U.S. dollars, because primarily it's all, like 70% of its operations is U.S. bonds in that sense. And so there could be some collateral within, let's say, U.S. equities and or U.S. bond structures. That's where it's going to be interesting. And if we look at like the precedent set in 2017 with the Bank of Spain that went that got absorbed, essentially 100% of these AT1 and or Tier 2 bondholders lost everything, essentially, because that's how it's structured.
Yeah, that was in, I think, 2017 with Banco Santander, you know, kind of gobbling up Banco, I want to say Popular, if I remember correctly. But the size of that COCO wipeout was like tiny compared to the $17 billion of Credit Suisse. I think it was under $2 billion, if I remember off the top of my head. But it's definitely, I think, you know, an issue now that we have this, you know, now it's Deutsche Bank, right? And it's, you know, it's very similar story. It's a credibility shock, and then deposits start to fly out the door, and it's just really hard to remain liquid when you have, you know, a credibility shock. And the risk of contagion, you know, a lot of it, you know, it might not be reflected in the fundamentals, but once you have kind of that risk, especially after people were, you know, Lehman and the financial crisis, nobody wants to be, you know, kind of holding on and making sure their bank is solvent. Deutsche Bank's AT1 bonds are, you know, also suffering from this. I think a lot of investors were really surprised that the Swiss National Bank just wiped out Credit Suisse's AT1 bonds. In hindsight, they probably should have, you know, $17 billion is really nothing, and they probably should have made those. You know, even though it's clearly written that they reverse convert into nothing, they probably should have made whole on some of them. So there was some kind of bond recovery, because, you know, and Deere and I talked about this like months, you know, what was that, like six months ago, about how they're not really bonds. They're like reverse convert into equity when you don't want it, or they're just like IOUs where they're like, never mind. We're not going to have any principal repayments. You could kind of argue they're not really even bonds, but it's definitely definitely a problem now with kind of like who's next, what's going to happen, and so much of the deposits flowing into money markets too. I think that's, you know, another really, really good point.
And yeah.
Sorry, David, just to that point on the Credit Suisse thing on those perpetual COCOs where they exceeded the coupon rate. The Credit Suisse did call those, and I forgot to add this. However, like I said, if they didn't, if they decided to announce a non-call, the price of those COCOs would have been slashed in half by 15% immediately. On the news of a non-call, right? So, I mean, these products are absolutely asinine. And, like, I just don't think people realize how significant, like, that can be. And then, like, kind of my final point is, you know, funding stress. And Nancy, you know how much I love cross-currency basis swaps. So it wouldn't be a space if I don't mention cross-currency basis swaps. But, I mean, if we look at that, we're seeing widening. And so now what I'm worried as well is that, you know, you're going to get this other catalyst where, you know, there's going to be further stress in the commercial paper and CD markets, and these debt instruments that are issued by, you know, banks to source funding from non-bank deposit, like non-bank investors, mostly of which are money market funds, are going to start to, you know, to face issues where you start to see these outflows of money market funds. And all of these European banks are going to get hit by the decline in both the volumes and maturities of CP and CD funding. And when those money market funds say, okay, we're no longer going to essentially be the marginal buyer, they're going to start to face dollar funding stress, which affects, you know, most of, not if all of, their long-term portfolios. Like in Europe, almost all long-term portfolios are US dollar denominated. And so now it's like you have the cocoa issue, and I feel that you're going to start to have a funding issue because, I mean, who wants to take on the counterparty risk there, right? Like if you're Goldman or JP Morgan or you know, Bank of America, like, are you really wanting to lend to Santander or BNP Paribas or Deutsche, or are you wanting to, you know, participate in you know, the cross currency basis swap transaction? Absolutely not, right? Like it's a ton of risk. And so therefore you have that withdrawal of that funding. And I'm expecting that we're probably going to see wild moves in all of these funding metrics, whether it be LIBOR minus OIS, or, you know, I know people say don't use LIBOR, but, you know, LIBOR minus OIS or other things. I think you're going to start to see wild moves there, and I'm not sure how that affects Europe either.
And one thing, sorry about that, Tracy, what we'll see is a continuation of reductions in conversion rates. We already saw it within France and in these pension structures, in the sense that we were usually legally at a 6.8 conversion rate for your pension structures. Now we're seeing a drastic reduction within France pension structure. And this is how you necessarily redeem solvency within these structures. You reduce its convertible rates. And so in essence, Swiss, after the actual Credit Suisse debacle, is considering lowering it to roughly 5.7. And then it gives a legal precedence towards, let's say, the Occupation Benefits Insurance Act to be revised from our legally established 6.8 to go down in that sense. And we're already seeing congressional precedents. Tracy, please go ahead. Sorry about that.
Oh, mine was just more of a question. So, and I'm sorry, I was late. So I don't know if you guys already talked about this, but, you know, we maxed out the overnight repo rate at 60 billion. Yesterday, and it was obviously somebody not covered by currency swaps. So I'm not sure this is exactly a coincidence after the Fed raised rates again. Do you guys think this is a one-off, or is this something we should be concerned about? It's a question for anybody that wants to answer.
I thought that was a utilization of the swap lines. Right, just recognize.
No, the FEMA is for people who can't utilize.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah, so Tracy, probably something like that. Somebody needs collateral, but they're giving the Fed treasuries and getting dollars, right?
Right. Obviously, somebody needs dollars, but do you think it's just a one off, or is this something that we should be concerned about? Right, because as the Fed keeps raising rates, it does affect the rest of the banking system across the world, right? Especially if you have, you know, especially with all the debt everybody's holding, or U.S. debt everybody's holding.
No, I would agree. And I mean, it's hard to talk. I know BRICS is kind of the front and center, but I talked with Michael Cowell and Thomas's Space about this last week. But like, even if you're to look at nations like the Saudis or the Chinese, you're seeing also a large amount of selling of treasuries. So, I mean, it could be a nation like that. I'm not sure if, those are anonymous, so it's really hard to see. I mean, it's almost impossible, except like the swap lines you can see. But the FEMA, I'm not sure if you could actually like dig down on who it was who utilized them. But I mean, like, once, if you look at the Chinese, I mean, the renminbi's volatility is crazy. They've been trying to sell treasuries, not because they hate the U.S., I would say, but because they're trying to stabilize the currency, much the same with the Saudis. And I look at like FX forward outrights for that. So kind of the market's anticipation of forward rates for FX pairs. And, you know, like if you look at the real, I think it's pegged at like 375, which is, I think, where the peg is. So like, even the market's not worried about depegging there, but the Saudis are selling treasuries because, you know, right now the real is relatively weak from, I think, where the Saudis want the peg to be. I think you're seeing much the same with the Chinese. So I would say it's
probably a currency stabilizing mechanism, but I'm not sure if Nancy has thoughts. Because a lot of times when people are doing that, they're trying to get dollars to stabilize FX reserves. And it could have even been Turkey. I know Turkey just had something very recent with FX. And also anytime Turkey expands the central bank balance sheet, it coincides with an increase in gross FX reserves. I haven't looked at the Turkish balance sheet as of this week. So it could be somebody like that trying to stabilize currencies as well.
And in theory, roughly, like after the Credit Suisse situation, wasn't it like almost $10 billion of the $17 billion that was wiped in US dollars terms?
In terms of COCOs, yeah.
I know we were coming up to 15 minutes before we end the spaces. I just want to maybe switch a bit from macro and talk about Nancy's investment strategy. I don't know if you can talk about specifics, but I want to hear a bit about your quadratic interest rate volatility and inflation head ETF and your quadratic deflation ETF. How should investors use your funds in their portfolios? Like, where does quadratic fit in? Maybe you can just talk a bit about that.
Oh, sure. So IVOL is mostly TIPS. Those are Treasury inflation protected securities, but we try to fix the issues that exist with TIPS. When I started my career in the late 90s at Goldman, it was right when the U.S. Treasury Department developed and issued TIPS. And I always kind of had a problem with that because it was like, wow, that's they're bonds. So, you know, all bonds have duration exposure. So all bonds lose money when yields go higher. And so I was like, we'll take TIPS and then we'll try to have a way to profit when 10-year yields go higher and bonds sell off. And so that's what one piece of the option trade does. And then also, I think it's kind of silly to use only the consumer price index. You know, I think you know, even the Fed doesn't just use CPI, and it's really hard to measure things like inflation. I think, you know, using one index, like nobody would ever buy, you know, the Dow Jones or the Russell or the NASDAQ to measure the U.S. equity market. It just seems kind of silly to do one index for inflation, because especially CPI, it's, you know, calculated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and so much of it is owner-occupied rent in the shelter component, about a third. So that's what IVOL is, like a TIPS product that tries to fix the issues with TIPS alone. But it also has the benefit of, it does both of our funds own volatility because they own options. It's not equity vol. Both of it is rate vol. And so I think that's one thing I've been really kind of vocal about for years, is just talking about, like, look, any place people have U.S. residential mortgages inside their portfolios, so like the Ag Index, a third of it is mortgages. Homeowners, very simply, are long the option to prepay in the United States. It doesn't exist in other countries where you have prepayment penalties. But in the U.S., homeowners can prepay whenever they want. And so any place that you have mortgage risk in the U.S., you're short vol. And that's what happened with Silicon Valley Bank, right? They didn't hedge that negative convexity or prepayment risk. And when interest rates go higher, people are rational and they don't prepay as quickly. And so the duration extends. So it's always the same thing. But both of the funds are long volatility, which I think is, you know, why only be short vol in your bond portfolio. So hopefully that's helpful, just as a quick one-liner. But
Nancy, just to the fund, for people who might not be as familiar with equity vol relative to interest rate vol, can you kind of talk about, like, because there's a lot of long vol equity vol funds out there, but, you know, can you kind of talk about why when you own equity options you bleed a lot, and kind of what, you know, equity vol funds have to do you know, to mitigate that, and how interest rate vol, you know, kind of like FX differentials, you get that positive roll, and actually what that means for people who are, for you guys, in terms of the basis points that you guys are able to distribute, and also kind of the difference there between equity and interest rate vol.
Yeah, so any, I guess, big picture, like any market that has an options market has to have a vol market because volatility goes into pricing options. So they're sort of like the terms are, you know, both jargon terms, but they're kind of interchangeable. Any options market has a vol market. So whether it's, you know, gold volatility or oil vol or, you know, interest rate vol or equity vol, there are lots of strategies out there that use equity options. I thought it would be a good idea to give access to the rate vol market because most people have that, you know, they have a single QSIP, but mortgages are all short fixed income volatility. So that's why, you know, kind of we did this by providing a single QSIP long vol product in the rate side. Again, like most people in the mortgage market used to hedge their short volatility prior to the Fed doing QE. And then, you know, after 15 years of QE, people just get lazy and stop hedging. So it's definitely, you know, something different. It's not always going to make money. And, you know, all investing involves risk. I'm always like, you know, cautious on these spaces to talk too much about the fund. And I don't want it to be a product pitch at all. But, you know, there's lots of information. They are public funds. They're listed on the New York Stock Exchange, so anybody can look it up and see what the funds have inside of them. But yeah, it's been really, there's very little, I'd say, people doing things differently in the financial markets. I'd say that's one thing. There's a lot of groupthink, you know, even these things about the CoCo securities are all over the place because so many people are benchmarking, and the way that the industry works, it's like, do you underperform or outperform the benchmark? So there's so much, you know, performance chasing and yield chasing and more of the same thing. So it's really been, you know, a pleasure to kind of give investors more choices and not just be short volatility in their bond portfolio. So,
and I just want to jump in here. Nancy has to leave before one because she has a meeting. So if you have any last minute questions, please get them in now. And Nancy, thank you so much for your time today.
And we'll, after Nancy, I know we'll wrap up on a couple of key points just on gold and oil. I know those are topics that we want to cover quickly, but definitely want to wrap up any questions with Nancy.
Margo, could I just ask Nancy two quick ones for kind of everyone's benefit?
Of course, go ahead.
Okay, so Nancy, I just want to make sure everyone watching, they have as good an understanding as they can on what your funds would do for them. So I was wondering if I could give you two scenarios and you can say just theoretically the way you've structured it, should iVol increase in those scenarios or what would you expect it would do? So the first one would be, say the Federal Reserve cuts the Fed funds to zero. Would iVol be expected to increase in that scenario?
Yes. So we have kind of four factors. One of them is the Fed lowering interest rates, or, you know, prior to, you know, Silicon Valley, it was not hiking as much as what was priced in. So lower front-dated yields are good for the options inside the strategy. So if the Fed went to zero, that would be a surprise to the market and likely a positive. We also own bonds. So the bonds are TIPS, so they're exposed to real yields, but likely the bonds would probably do well in that environment too.
Okay, great. And then the second scenario is, say inflation picks back up and long-term rates start to increase on expectations of higher for longer inflation. Is that what iVol increase in that scenario?
Yes, exactly. And it's really amazing to me how complacent the forward markets are about inflation. Like, I agree, you know, CPI could go negative. It definitely could fall, the last print being 6. But forward inflation expectations are pretty much right around, like, I'm looking at the five-year, it's 2.23 right now. The 5-year forward inflation rate is 2.12. The 5-year break even is 2.29. The 10-year is 2.23. So it's sort of like the markets have a tremendous amount of confidence that the Fed by hiking policy rates is going to ease inflation in the future. And I think that's kind of a good opportunity for investors, because I just don't know, with all the backdoor QT that's happening and with all the balance sheet expansion, whether the rate hikes, I feel like it's kind of like it doesn't have the historical sensitivity to actually reduce inflation, but they've definitely reduced forward inflation. And Powell said that not at this week's rate hike, but the last one, he said disinflation, you know, I don't know, over 10 times, disinflation, and disinflation is being priced in. And so I think it's to me, a pretty compelling opportunity, because real yields have not been this attractive in a long time. And I don't know, obviously, you know, I do think inflation is also a global situation. You know, it's not just in this country, it's really around the whole world. And I think especially, I don't mean to bring up like a bigger, broader topic, but we have, you know, the labor market is something that is very, very tight, and the Fed can't control that. And we have a lot of, depending on the state, a lot of stimulus happening with inflation relief checks going in the mail to help people fight inflation in their day-to-day lives. But you have to kind of think about the second order impacts of what that's going to do to the participation rate in the labor market. And, you know, we also have so much additional backdoor QE going on with the Fed expanding their balance sheet. So it's a tough situation, I think, for investors, but, you know, they're out there. So, you know, you can ask your financial advisor, read the prospectus, or we'd be happy to answer any questions. And I'm sorry I have to go. I have a previously scheduled 1 o'clock meeting, but I really enjoy joining you all. I appreciate you having me up, and I hope this was helpful. It's definitely a pretty wild time with what's going on in the markets right now. It's like the Fed is, you know, seems like they're not aware of what they're doing, to me, at least.
Well, it was great to get professional insight from you with all of your years experience at your own firm in Goldman Sachs in the credit market. So thank you so much for joining us, Nancy.